Well, our reading in Job starts us today in chapter 1 again at verse 13. We read through to the end of the chapter at verse 22. If you haven't a Bible with you, the words will be on the screen for you this morning. Job chapter 1 and verse 13. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead. And I am the only one who's escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Job in crisis, and we look forward to thinking through those words a bit more later on in our service this morning. I guess many of you have had a bad hair day. Be careful where I look just now in case you think I'm querying the hairstyle you have at present. I do feel sorry for those who've had a bad hair day. I can't ever remember having one myself. But you understand the imagery. I gather the term first came into prominence in the film Buffy the Vampire Slayer, when Buffy turned to the one-armed vampire Amberlynn and said, "I'm fine, but you're obviously having a bad hair day." Although there is a claim that it didn't come from an American film originally, but came from English origin in 1991, when a certain Dr. Alexander Bartis, a much inspired and creative soul, at the age of 17, uttered those words when she arrived at school, having woken up late, having burnt the toast, and then realised she could do nothing with her hair. Wherever it came from, a bad hair day is now part of our language, a description of those days in life when everything seems to go wrong. It seems a bit of a trivial term to use in terms of Job. In this passage we read together this morning, it is a series of catastrophes and crises, one on top of another. So instead of calling it a bad hair day for Job, though I was tempted, I've called it an incredible day for Job. Incredible at all kinds of levels. A day that seems to have no other parallel in any other human being's life in the whole of history. Truly incredible, unbelievable bad day for Job. I say it's an incredible day, first of all, for it was so unexpected. There's no sign on the horizon of his life that trouble was brewing. As we saw last week, the paragraph previous warns the readers like ourselves of what's about to happen, although perhaps not even as bad as this when it does happen. We have that picture of the council of heaven with God calling and summoning all his angels before him and Satan appearing and God prodding and probing Satan. Have you thought about Job? Satan saying, aye, but he only loves you because you're good to him, not because you're actually God. And Satan then being given permission to take any of the blessings God has given to Job away from him with God's absolute confidence in Job. That Job had what it takes to stand against all that that's inflicted upon him. We're prepared for it. But when we hit verse 13 and Job's family are having another great celebration, it's a happy day, it's a joyful day, they're in high spirits, there's not a cloud on their horizon, literally or certainly metaphorically speaking. And then suddenly, from nowhere, one tragedy after the other makes it an incredible day. I guess sometimes life's like that for us, isn't it? It seems to be when things are at their best, we seem to reach the zenith, a wonderful state of calm and peace, and that suddenly becomes the day when everything seems to go wrong. Not just an incredible day because of its unexpected nature, but this progressive situation of things getting worse after worse, wave upon wave of trouble hitting him. There's a kind of ominous note to that phrase. While he was still speaking, first messenger comes with the first piece of bad news, and then while he was still speaking, it's written in a kind of poetic style, echoed one messenger after another. But if his poetic style, it still reflects an actual happening, an actual reality. And the poetic style simply reinforces it. That while the first bearer of bad news is still speaking, the next one with worse news comes to Job. Job doesn't get a chance to catch his breath. He's no time to digest one piece of tragic news till there's an outburst of further and worse bad news on its way. He hasn't got time to acclimatize to how things have turned out for the worse when a worse scenario is brought to him. He can't take in the enormity of the consequences of the first piece of bad news till he's trying to digest the second and the third and the fourth piece of bad news on top. And I guess we've all been there, some more so than others, at some point in life. Some one thing that we could have just about felt we could handle. And yet we haven't got round to handling it till something else steamrollers into our lives. And we just feel we can't cope with it all. We have kinship with the person who, drowning at sea, feels if there's just one wave or if the waves were a bit better spaced out, they could cope. But it's just this crashing of one wave on top of the other that leaves them breathless, helpless, floundering and feeling they're dying. An incredible day for Job. Incredible, thirdly, because of how total this was. All of his flocks, all of his servants, and then each of his family circle, bar his wife. The things which he looked at and believed to be the blessings that God had provided him with. We said last week and the week before that one of the brilliant things about those opening verses of Job chapter 1 is that Job recognized that these were God's blessings. He believed they were what God had given to him. He didn't see himself as being the brilliant author of his own destiny. He was content to say that the Lord had given to him. And that was a reality. God had looked down upon Job and found him exemplary and provided him with one blessing after the other in the course of his life. And it's those things which he believed with all his heart to be God's blessings which now are being removed systematically one after the other from him. An incredible day. An incredible day because of how complex it was. Can you imagine Job, as this news filters through, trying to grapple and trying to understand, what on earth is going on in my life here? Why is this happening to me? Some of the things that happened to him come, if you like, through human agents. So you have the Sabaeans in verse 15 and then the Chaldeans in verse 17. If Job had had enough time to try and digest what was going on, he might have said, here I am, a godly person, blessed by God, but I'm in an evil world. I'm in a fallen world, and bad things happen when bad people do them. And there's the bad Sabaeans, and there's the bad Chaldeans, and what I'm suffering is bad people doing bad things to a good person. But it's not all human agency here in Job chapter 1. In verse 16, we read this lightning of God falling from heaven, or the fire of God falling from heaven. Different versions, different translators and interpreters take a different line. Some think it was simply lightning. Lightning that could have simply kindled a fire on the plain and swallowed up all these vast numbers of animals. Another translator takes it as a volcano, volcanic activity that did the same thing to his livestock. Then we have this powerful wind in verse 19. Again, translates sometimes a tornado, sometimes a cyclone. We're not given an exact description, just something that swept away the house in which his sons and daughters were reveling. How does Job understand this fire of God and this powerful wind in its destructive power? I guess as someone who knew God as a creator God, God in charge of his universe, something would filter in his head, this is God. Again, we know from what goes before. In fact, it was Satan being given the liberty to handle these things against Job. But how does Job grapple with this incredible day, these complex things happening to him, trying to understand all that's happening? An incredible day that Job had to put up with, not even given time to think his way through all that's happening. When things do go bad in our lives, when we have our proverbial bad hair days, when one storm seems to batter us after the other, we're sometimes tempted to think, I can't survive this. No one has ever been asked to put up with what I'm being asked to put up with. You run a high risk in our evangelical world of someone coming along and telling you with a nice warm slap on the back, ah, don't worry because Jesus went through far worse things than that. Which, of course, is profoundly true. And that's why we sang those two songs we did. What Jesus went through on the cross, physically, mentally, emotionally, socially, and primarily spiritually, was a darker hour than any human being will ever enter. But if you're the sufferer and the crises have come piling in on your life and someone says, well, Jesus has been there, you well risk being told, but I'm not Jesus. Now, he was a son of God. He knew what was coming. He understood the end from the beginning. I'm not like that. And so we're not. But I think there is comfort for us when we hear the psalmist describing his experience paralleling this, where he says, all your waves and your billows have come over me. And he knew what it was like to go through days, periods of time in life when it wasn't just one trouble to be handled and coped with as best we can with the grace of God. It was just this deluge that comes in upon life. We turn back to this incredible day of Job's. And when there's something that says inside us, no human being can be asked to cope with that, we go back and say, but Job did go there. And Job did have that incredible day. And Job did survive. And he wasn't a New Testament Christian with all the resources of the New Testament to rely upon. He's simply somebody who stands there with a view of God as his creator and God as a provider of what has come, and in that responds to the crisis that comes. And of course, we can go back to the previous paragraph or two. And in those paragraphs, remind ourselves that God knew that Job would survive. It's one of the great themes we want us to keep on referring to as we go through this whole book of Job. God knew that Job would survive. Not because God would give him extra resources, not because God would send a whole legion of angels to help him out, but simply God knew how he had constructed Job spiritually. And if he didn't know that, God wouldn't have set the ball rolling in Job's life. God will not put us in a position we cannot cope with. Even though sometimes we say, God, I think I can't cope. God says to us, I'll never put you in a situation where spiritually you cannot cope, however incredible the day may be. So first of all, it's an incredible day for Job. Secondly, for Job, an inevitable grief. Verse 20 gives us just a tiny glimpse of Job's grief. We know, of course, in a much fuller picture of grief in all its shapes and sizes will come to us in later parts of Job's life and experience. Initially, we simply, Job tore his robe and shaved his head. Here's a good illustration that there are things in Scripture which are recorded factually and they're culturally relevant for that situation that don't have to be made culturally relevant for ourselves in the same way. So the next time you go through grief, you're not required biblically to tear your robe and shave your head. No problem if you want to do that, that's fine, but no requirement of it. It's simply that was a culturally proper way for Job to express his grief. That was normal grief for him. What I want to focus for a minute to is simply to say that grief is appropriate for God's people. Here was Job, who'd been held up by God as a near perfect example of God-fearing and moral living. He was a supreme example. Satan attacks Job because he is such a high-ranking follower of the living God. And grief is part of what Job goes through. Job is not unmoved emotionally. Job was not a fatalist who finds this incredible barrage of bad things happening and then simply kind of shrugs his shoulders, well, okay, sarah, sarah, what's to be, and that's just what happens in life. He's not a fatalist, unmoved by the things that happen. He does grieve. I think that modern Christianity has learnt that grief's okay. Have in the past been those who've believed that grieving is a sign of spiritual weakness. That when tragedy or calamity comes, whether it's in death and mourning, whether it's in the loss of business, whether it's in a broken relationship, whether it's in that sense of children going off and leaving you and abandoning you and the heartache that comes from that, whatever kind of loss it is, there has in the past been a view, well, don't show any emotion. Don't grieve, because you should simply take that from God's hand. The Lord gave and the Lord take away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Just put a big grin on your face and pretend you're not hurting. I think this passage is so, so important. For the first reaction of Job is to grieve, and to grieve in a culturally appropriate fashion for him. There have been those Christians in the past who read Paul's words to Thessalonians, "We do not grieve like those who have no hope," and have interpreted that as we don't grieve at all. What Paul's actually saying is we don't grieve in the same way as those who grieve without any hope. Rather, Paul's saying we are a people who have a sure and a certain hope. We know that Christ is coming back again. We know that Christ will raise from the dead those who've died in Christ. And so while we do grieve, our grief isn't the same as those who are hopeless and in despair. But some have misinterpreted that. And thought, well, Christians don't grieve. And sadly, many have bottled up unexpressed grief in themselves to one day it bursts into spiritual despair, physical illness, or mental breakdown. Job does grieve. Paul expects the Thessalonians to grieve. Jesus wept. And whether that grief, I say, is about human loss in death, or whether other kinds of loss that we experience through the course of life, the kind of bad hair days that Job's having, grief is entirely proper. Not only that, grief was culturally relevant for Job. In his culture, in his setting, stripping, tearing off the outer garment and shaving the head completely was a sign of proper grief. But every culture and every age has different ways of grieving. And Christians need to understand there's nothing wrong with grieving in ways that are appropriate to our culture. I think it'd be improper, be odd, if the next time you're grieving over something, you did shave your head, especially if you're a woman. It might have odd consequences in your family and friends if you try to emulate that kind of grief process. We know that in New Testament days, in Galilee, in Christ's day, they paid professional mourners to come in and do the wailing, the beating of breasts that was appropriate to that culture. If the next time you're grieving, you try to rent a mob from here or elsewhere to come to your house and beat their breasts and wail at the top of their voices, people might think you're gone a wee bit odd. There's nothing wrong with it, but it wouldn't be appropriate to your culture. There's no need for us to criticize the Ulster customs of wakes and black ties and sympathy cards. That's how it's done in our culture, and it's perfectly appropriate. You might say, but I don't see it in the Bible. I don't see any spiritual reasoning for it, and there probably isn't. But it's grief that fits our own culture, and that has a place. I could make a good case, I think, for displaying the Christian's hope and the Christian's joy even in a time of sorrow and grief, by coming to the next funeral that I conduct dressed in a white suit with a red shirt and a very bright tie. Some of you remember Jean Berg, the pastor in Brussels many years ago, and he did a funeral in a Catholic church in Paris in exactly that format. He didn't normally wore very dark clothing, but his view was here was an opportunity for him to speak at a converted person's funeral in an era and in a situation where most folks had never heard the gospel at all. So he went with a white suit on and a big red rose in his lapel to conduct this funeral service. His point was, this isn't a drab, drear, sad, hopeless occasion. So I'll preach with white suit on, a sign of the forgiveness this person has in Christ, and the hope we have in Christ, and the assurance of new life in eternity. But in case you're getting worried, in case yours is the next funeral here, I don't think it'd be particularly appropriate for me to wear a white suit and a red shirt and a flamboyant tie. It'd be culturally inappropriate. It'd send the wrong message out to all your... You might understand it. Your family might just about handle it. But the wider world said, what kind of odd bods are those? It'd be inappropriately cultural. And for that reason, I think it wouldn't be appropriate for us. So grief is here for Job, and it's grief appropriate to his culture. Trying to airbrush shock, tears, grief, loss, sadness out of reality isn't what's being called for here. Focusing on the positive spirit of verse 21, which we're coming to in a minute, but bypassing the reality of verse 20 is neither necessary or helpful. Job faces this incredible day, and he experiences, first off, genuine grief expressed in a culturally relevant manner. An incredible day, inevitable grief, but then this invaluable response, thirdly. An invaluable response. You can't put a price on the response made by Job. The danger is that you and I read this passage and think, well, okay, Job did that, but actually, that's not very real. It's impossible for someone to face such immense suffering and respond in this particular fashion. And in a way, it is worth saying, this isn't how Job always responded. As we'll see very soon in the following chapters, there were other situations in which Job didn't respond in this way. But I think he responds here in this situation this way, and it's a good pattern for us to take note of and a good goal for us to aim for. It's just a reminder that even Job didn't have some kind of automatic programmed chip inside of him that made him respond in exactly the same monotonous way in every situation. And we don't do that either. I think it's lovely when you talk to folks around the church who've experienced grief and trial through varied situations in life. And you'll say, you know, when the first black experience hit me, I responded this way. 3 years later, when something hit me, I responded this way. 5 years later, when something else happened, I responded that way. And it's simply saying we aren't automatons programmed to respond in exactly the same way every single time. But when we read this example of Job, it's worth saying this is a valid, possible way for God's people to respond to incredible days such as Job had. Here's a heartfelt response of someone who's both deeply grieving and deeply worshipping at the same time. He falls to the ground. I love the way the Hebrew writes here, because you could imagine that it says, well, he ripped his robe, he shaved his head, and he fell to the ground in absolute despair. It doesn't say that, does it? He ripped his robe, he shaved his head, and he fell to the ground in worship. An incredibly difficult, painful day for him. But he didn't lose his grip on God. It's what Satan wanted him to do. It's what Satan was planning to happen. It's what Satan expected to happen. Satan believed with all his heart, if I take every blessing away from Job, he will then curse God. He won't profess love for God anymore. He won't fear God anymore. He won't worship God anymore. But God had a better view of Job than that. And when everything has been taken away from Job, and Job is in the depths of shock and of grief, Job is still a worshipping human being. It's a product, I think, of two views of God. I think Job worships God because he's always believed that he is a created being, created by that God and for that God. And his other view of God is he views himself, Job, as a recipient or a steward of God's goodness to him. If you take the first of those, as a created being, he acknowledges he will leave this world as empty-handed as he came into it. Naked I came from my mother's breast, or from my mother's womb, and naked I'll leave it. Here's a sense that the wonder of the human being, as a human being, is not the wonder of what we have, not the wonder of what we own, not the wonder of what we can do. The wonder of the human being that comes into the world as a helpless little baby is the wonder of being made in the image and likeness of God. Job seems to have kept hold of that. I think in our sophisticated world, we've often lost it. When we try to value or to put a value on a human life, we instinctively do it in terms of what the person can do, or what the person has achieved, or what the person owns, or what the person possesses, and we filter our understanding of the value of human life in that direction. Job doesn't. The value of the human being for him, that little baby who came helpless into the world, was that baby was created in the image and likeness of God. Very important truth. Not just for our times of crisis, although it applies to that, but in times of hardship, in times of poverty, when the baby is disabled, when the person's old and grey and can't do very much. That the value of the human being is the value of it being made in the image and likeness of God. Not what we own, not what we have, not what we can do, not what we possess. And that's why our value to God is always the same, whatever our changing circumstances in life might be. So when Job has every blessing taken from him, he still knows he's valuable to the God who created him. And that value remains from the day of one's birth to the day of one's death. Isn't that brilliant? The other view of God he has is about being a recipient or a steward of God's blessings. All he has been given actually belongs to God all the time. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He's been allowed to look after some of God's possessions for a while. Those sheep, those goats, those camels, those sons and daughters, those servants, all of those ultimately were actually God's. And Job was just a steward, a caretaker of the things that really belonged to God from start to finish. For those of you who are avid tennis fans, you'll notice that Victoria Azarenka won the Australian Tennis Open yesterday and was presented with the Daphne Akhurst Memorial Cup. She lifted it high. She posed for all the regulation media photographs. But she didn't get ownership of that cup. She just got to look after it for a wee while. In fact, she hasn't got it for a year even. She will apparently get a replica of it, but the actual cup that she held in her hands was hers to look after for, I think, about 3 hours. And then it's taken away from her, and those who own it in Melbourne will keep it there forever. It's theirs. She just had it to enjoy, to revel in for a very brief spell of time. That's how Job looked at his possessions. God had given them to him to enjoy, to treasure, to value, to steward and care for a while. And then God can take them away because they're God's, not Job's. It's that view of things that helps Job to handle his incredible day. It's a lesson I think we find hard to learn, to treat our families, to treat our possessions, to treat our blessings in life like that. If we can learn that lesson, it helps us when grief and loss come. We can actually then say with Job, "The Lord gave and the Lord took away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Not with a kind of stiff upper lip saying, "Oh, well, God has a right to do what he wants to do, so I just have to grin and bear it." But to say, "Wasn't it brilliant that for that period of time, God trusted me with his possessions and allowed me to enjoy them?" Helps us cope with the grief and the loss when it happens. But perhaps even more than that, it helps to really treasure the gift while I have it. If Victoria yesterday knew that she was only going to get that trophy for 3 or 4 hours, she would make the most of every last second and enjoy it to the full. And if we can filter our minds to see that everything we have in life, all of our family, all of our possessions, all of our belongings, every good and perfect gift that has come down from heaven above, if we could only learn to see it as something God has given us to enjoy for a wee while, because it actually belongs to him, wouldn't we treasure it all the more richly? If we saw those things as God's, something that he treasures, not the product of my sweat and tears and heartache and all the rest of life, but actually his, wouldn't we value it all the more? And if we can see these things as Job did, it helps us make sure that the giver is always much more precious to us than the gift. Which goes right back to the heart of where Job's strength lay. Satan didn't believe it was possible that someone would love the giver more than the gifts. Job was to prove that when all the gifts were gone, he still loved and worshipped the giver. So in verse 22, we discover that Job did not say or think or feel that God had wronged him in any way. In all these things, he didn't sin. His day of crisis had become a day of triumph over Satan, and he didn't even know it. Didn't know it. But his attitude to God was such that God could allow those tragedies to come, crisis after crisis after crisis, in an incredible day, to leave him with genuine and inevitable grief, but to lead him to this invaluable expression of worship of God. And God grant that it will be the same in our lives, in our crises. If you get up tomorrow morning and it's a bad hair day for you, and then you get to work and it's 10 times worse, then when you get back home it's 10 times worse again, to be able to say the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.